All right, so let's get started here. This is the assignment due today. Right? Most of you who are here have completed their assignment, I'm assuming. Most of you who aren't here are trying to finish it up. How is it going? Close to being done? Okay, so remember there's one more coming. Yep.
So the readme file and the sample output should be in a different directory from the source files?
I'm not sure why.
Or just put them in one.
Yeah, just put them in one. I don't think it matters. You are anyway uploading to Spark, right? So somebody, i.e. the TA, has to download and look at everything. So one zip file would be fine. Okay? Yeah.
On the assignment, it says we'll give you 20 points for being not linear.
Yep.
Does that mean there are extra points?
No, it's part of the assignment. And it's only 20 points for the second part, right? I mean, the first, doing the first part of the assignment, which is the first fit, you are going to end up doing a linear search. So the point was, if for best fit, if you do anything better than linear search, you get those 20 points.
So you lose 20 points if you don't?
Yes.
Okay.
Any other questions here?
So do you want to flag the turn compaction on top, or do you want?
No, just for the second part, which is the compaction, just submit a second program.
Oh, you want a separate program?
You can. If your program does the same thing, still submit two directories, so you can actually, with the readme file, how to start each one or something. Okay? Doesn't matter.
Can we do three compact and then
What's the question? Sorry?
When do you have to do the compaction? Like in a separate...
When do you have to do the compaction? Is that...
During the program's execution?
I think you can decide when to do it, but at the very least, if there is a hole, I mean not a hole, external fragmentation, I mean you cannot find a hole, that's a good time to run it. Right? Your code, yes. If you can submit the same code, that's fine. You don't have to take that part out, but just make sure that source file actually disables compaction, so you can actually see that when there is external fragmentation, it throws an error saying I cannot allocate. But if you had compaction in the second part or the same trace, maybe you will do compaction and then actually find enough space. So that's what we are going to test really. In the first part, it should not do that. We are going to look for, we are actually going to construct cases where your program should actually throw an error saying there isn't enough space. Okay? So if you have compacted and because it's not required, you have to do it. It's so clearly spelled out that you don't do compaction here. Do free block coalescing in the first part, that's what was mentioned, which is not the same as compaction. Okay? Any other questions on this? Last minute clarifications? Okay. Yeah, you have another one. No, you should. It's just everything in the first part plus do compaction. Okay? Alright, so let's continue our discussion on I/O systems. A recap from last time, we studied all these different disk scheduling mechanisms. Okay, we looked at first come, first serve. We looked at SSTF, shortest seek time first, and we looked at scan. There's one clarification there. I actually mentioned that there are two variants of scan, which is one is called scan and there's one called look. What I said each of them does is actually the opposite. Okay. In scan, okay, you always scan from the innermost track to the outermost track and then you go backwards. Okay, even if there are no requests, you will actually go all the way to the end. Look is that optimization which will stop if you go from, let's say, all the way to I. If there are no more requests from I through N, you will not do this. You will actually turn reverse direction and go back. Last time I said it was the opposite. Okay? Scan is the one that always is like the elevator. Pure elevator algorithm. Always starts at the lowest floor, it goes all the way to the upper floors. Okay? Even if there is no request, it will go all the way to the top and then reverse direction and come back down. That's called scan. Okay? And the optimization, which is if the elevator is going up, let's say it hit floor 10, there are no requests, there's no nobody waiting to get off at higher floor, nobody has pressed the button, there's no reason to go up, it can turn directions and go come back down. That optimization is don't go all the way to the end, stop if there are no more requests in that direction, and reverse direction is called look. Okay? So it was the opposite was what I said last time, which was incorrect. Yes, question.
So the zero track is on the inside or the outside?
Zero track is in the, on the inside, but it really doesn't matter how you number it, right? But typically it's on the inside. Any other question? Okay. So keep that in mind. Okay. So the book will actually tell you this, which is exactly what is correct. And I said the wrong thing last time. Okay. So now, actually before I do tertiary storage, I had some slides on RAID storage. Just one slide to explain how disks are used in larger systems like servers. Okay. So typically on a laptop or a desktop, you may have one disk, sometimes you may have two disk drives, and you use these disks individually. Okay, you construct file systems or volumes on them and you use them. Okay. In larger servers, what you have is if you have a need for more capacity, what you do is you take a collection of disks and you use that as a larger logical I/O subsystem. Okay. Typically, this larger subsystem is referred to as a disk array. Okay, it's essentially an array or a collection of disks. Okay, you may have an arbitrary number, let's say n. N is greater than 1. Okay, so now in a disk array, you don't manage these disks individually. Okay, it's not like if you have 100 disks, you will basically have 100 file systems and 100 drives. What you do or what the hardware does is it takes all of these disks and it provides the abstraction of a single larger logical disk to the operating system. As far as the OS is concerned, this entire collection of disks looks like a single large logical disk, which has the storage space that's equal to the sum of the storage space on this disk. Okay, this is referred to as a logical disk or a logical disk array abstraction. Hey, is that clear what I just said? So, yes, you have a question here. Okay. So, I'll come to what happens. If you add one, question is what happens when you add one. So, basically you can dynamically change things is the short answer. In the old days, you had to redo everything. Okay? So, now the question is, if you have this logical array abstraction, how are files actually mapped onto these disks? Okay, this basically looks like, as far as the OS is concerned, one large disk. Okay. So that the way you do layout on these disk arrays is a technique referred to what is called striping. Okay. Striping basically says spread files across multiple disks. Okay. Until now, everything they said is that take a file and put it on that disk. Okay. You can decide whether to store it contiguously on sectors and whatnot. But whenever you have disk arrays, you basically take a file, you chop it up into pieces, okay? So you can put the first block of the file on disk 1, the second file block on disk 2, third block on disk 3, fourth on disk 4, and then you cycle back, okay? So first, fifth block goes here, and so on and so forth, okay? So every file is actually spread across, so that's one. What I'm showing here is that first thing here. We look at all these other things. Okay, so every file is actually spread across all of those four disks. Okay, you'll chop it up into blocks and you'll store blocks in round robin manner. Okay, this layout policy is called striping, with the fact that you're storing this on multiple disks, all disks in your disk array. Okay, is that clear? What a disk array is and what striping is? So you can ask the question, why do this? Okay, why not just take a file and store it on some disk in the array, like you would do normally? Okay, why would you want to actually scatter a file across multiple disks? What does this give you? Right. So the point that was just made here is, if you scatter the blocks of the file across the disks in your array, you can effectively use the entire throughput of all of the disks. Okay, your logical disk appears as if it is n times as fast. So if you wanted to read this file sequentially, you would basically send 4 requests for 4 blocks to 4 disks, okay, and read them in parallel. Okay, so you basically have constructed a parallel device, which and you are getting the throughput of all of the disks. You can use the throughput of all of the disks. Okay, that's a key advantage. Okay, so not only are you basically getting this abstraction of a single large logical disk, you also get an abstraction of a faster disk. Okay, or a disk that has n times effectively the throughput of a single disk in the subsystem. If you have stored this file only on this disk, okay, then you basically will try to access it. You can only max throughput that you get is the max throughput of that single disk. Okay, but if you store it on n, and as n goes larger, you can get higher and higher throughputs. Okay, the other advantage, are there other advantages here? So what do you see will happen if you store all files on all disks? Yep. Okay, so there's an issue that's just brought up, which is what the second hard disk fails, you can use it. We'll come back to failures in just one moment. Okay, that is indeed an advantage, but there is, and we will talk about how to handle disk failures and how this can tolerate them and so on. Okay, but since I did not provide that background, we'll just keep that aside for just one second. Come back to it. Other things? Or let me flip the question. If you had actually used these disks individually, okay, what kind of disadvantages would you see of doing that? Yep.
Overall, it would be a little bit slower because you would be able to search as much as the kids are, but you get more space to search.
Okay, so space, I think, at this level, probably. So the point is about searching. So in some sense, if you have good index structure, you don't have to search. You will basically be told your inode will point to the right disk and you don't have to do this. But if you really had to search, then you are searching more disks. Okay, that is indeed true. File system, if it has an index structure like the ones we have talked about, you will just have to go to the right disk and get it. But the important thing, let me just give you a clue. The important thing is if you are managing all of these disks individually, you have to decide manually what data goes where. Okay. You have to load balance the workload as well as the storage space manually. Right. So now suppose you put file 1 here, okay, and file 1 and file 2, and you put file 3 here. Okay. Suppose that file 1 and file 2 are very heavily accessed. Okay. This disk is going to get overloaded, and all these disks here may be sitting idle. Is that clear? So if you manage this disk individually, you have imbalances across disks because you don't know when you store a file what is the access frequency. Okay, is this the file going to get accessed a lot? Not, you don't know that a priori. So you have to just make a guess and store it on one of the disks. If you make an incorrect guess, you will actually have imbalance. Okay, but if you stripe, that's not the case. Okay, because all files are striped across all the disks. Every access to any file uses all of the throughput available to it. So the load actually gets balanced across all of the disks. Okay. Storage space management is easier. Okay. If you create, let's say, your C drive here and your D drive here, and you use the C drive more than the D drive, this space will fill up and the disk space on this other disk may not fill up as quickly. If you store it across all of the disks, you will basically fill them up at the same rate. Okay, so there are all of these advantages. Higher throughput, better load balancing, better use of storage space. Okay, so this is basically, these are subsystems that are used in server class machines. Okay, when you have lots of disks, I mean lots of capacity needs. Okay, so that's one thing. Yeah, yes, your question.
What rate scheme is this? Are you having it so that every copy of every file is on each disk? Or
no.
Like you can have a part of a file on one disk and a part of a file on another disk?
Yeah, so basically every file, any file system, takes a file and partitions it into blocks. Okay, that's even on a single disk file system. The same is true here, except that you take these blocks and you put the first block on this disk, the second block on the second disk, third block on the third disk, and so on. Okay? Sorry? Yes, we'll come back to failures in just 1 second. Okay, so that's why I said we'll keep that aside and we'll come back to it. For now, assume that everything works fine. So now you just store these blocks. This looks like, from a OS perspective, this just looks like one big disk. Okay, so you can access any blocks as you would do on a single disk. Okay, you can just go, I want block 4. You'll just figure out where the block 4 is. You'll go send a request to that disk and access it. Okay, so nothing else has changed from that perspective. You're not required to access all of the blocks. But if you send multiple requests, you will parallelize those accesses. If you send only one block request, you will go to exactly the disk where it's stored and access it. Okay? Yes? Question? Sorry, what's the question? You would have solid state drives?
It wouldn't help on solid state drives.
No, even in solid state drives, you will basically, if you need more capacity for your server, then you have space on a single disk. This is what you end up doing. Why would that not be a much of a speed increase? You have 4 solid state disks. Okay, so if you have striped blocks and you want to access the whole file, you will basically send requests in parallel. Each disk will do its work in parallel and send back requests. So you have a system that's 4 times as fast. Just simple parallelizing of I/O across disks. It doesn't matter whether it's hard disks or solid state disks. Okay. So we looked at all the advantages: faster throughput, higher throughputs, better load balancing, better use of storage space, and whatnot. But as has been pointed out, there is a limitation of the approach, which is if one disk fails, okay, all files in your file system become unavailable, because all files are spread across all of the disks, so you lose a part of every file. Okay? If you had managed these disks individually, okay, if one disk fails, you only lose data that was stored on those disks. All these other disks have their individual file system, nothing has changed for them. Okay? So this is the only disadvantage of a RAID, or not a RAID, but a disk array system, which is disk failures cause the entire storage subsystem to become unavailable, okay, meaning you lose data. Okay, if you had individual disks, which in industry term is called a J-board, just a bunch of disks, okay, that's what it means. So if you had a J-board system, then if one disk fails, the others are still there and all the file system that you constructed on them stays as is. Okay? So now then the question is, you want to retain the advantage, but somehow you don't want to have this problem that arises when disks fail. Okay, because if you have 100 of these and one disk fails, then everything on your entire, it's a 100 terabyte system, becomes unavailable. Okay, that you don't want. So what you have is this thing called RAID, okay, which is called redundant array of independent disks. Okay, so R is redundant array of, so it's basically a disk array, a special kind of disk array that stores extra redundancy on disks, so that if any one disk fails, you still can access your data. Okay, that's basically what RAID does. It's a disk array, except that it is a disk array with some redundancy that is built into it. Okay, as has been shown here, okay, there are different types of RAID systems. Okay, that goes all the way from RAID 1 to RAID 6. Okay, so I'm going to quickly go through them, not go through a lot of detail here. Okay. Okay, the first one is RAID 0, which is what I just showed you. Okay, no redundancy. So if there is a disk failure, data is gone. Okay, you have to go back to tape backup or something and recover it. Okay, RAID 1 is called mirroring. Okay, what is done here is you have n disks. You partition your array into 2 pieces, okay, and you stripe across the left half, and then the right half is basically just mirrored. Whatever is stored here, you have a copy of that there. Okay, just full duplication of data. The simplest RAID 1 system is just 2 disks, where one disk is just replicating the content of the other disk, okay, in real time. Everything, every request, every write request is actually sent to both disks, so both disks are always in sync, up to date with one another. Okay? RAID 0 is mirroring. RAID 1 is pure mirroring. You just take end disk, you chop it up into two parts, okay? And then whatever is being done on the left half is replicated on the right half. Okay? Now, if a disk fails, okay, there's a copy of it on the other subarray. So data does not become unavailable. Okay, is that clear? What we just did, we basically made a copy of the data, so if there are two copies of everything. Okay, so if one copy goes away, the other one is still there. Okay, so you are fine. Okay, so now the disadvantage of this approach is that either your hardware cost has doubled. If you want 100 terabytes of storage space, you have to buy 200 terabytes of disk. Okay, so twice the cost, or you have the storage for the same cost. They are basically the same thing. Yeah, because you're keeping a copy of everything, you're 100% over it, either in terms of cost or storage space. Okay, but nevertheless, you handle the disk failure problem. Okay, so if you are buying 1 terabyte, instead of paying $100, you'll have to buy 2 terabytes, 2 disks, $200, and you mirror. Okay, that's what is done in the simplest subsystem. Okay, now, so other RAID levels, RAID 2 and onwards, okay, basically use more smarter schemes to create replicas. Okay, so here you basically just created one bit for every bit, was the basic point, or one byte. For every byte stored here, there's a copy of that byte stored there. Okay, there's 100% overhead. There are better schemes that have a lower redundancy overhead that give you similar properties that can handle a disk failure. Okay, so that's what other RAID levels do. And I'm going to give you the concept and just talk about one of the many RAID levels rather than going through them in all of the detail. Okay, the way to do this is use what is called parity. Or do parity encoding. You know, the basic point of parity is very simple. Okay, it's basically saying that if you have a bit, okay, if you have two variables, A and B, binary variable, Boolean variables, okay, if you do an XOR of them, I presume people know what XOR is, right? Okay. So soon 201 is going away, so people will not know what XOR is. Okay, so you compute the XOR. Okay, so let's... So if you have A and B as two variables, you compute A XOR B, that gives you a value P. Okay? So if you basically on your disk array, you store A, B and P on three separate disks. Okay? And the point is A and B are two data blocks and P is what is called your parity block. And if any of these two disks fail, okay, you can reconstruct what is on the failed disk using this parity information. And the simple reason why you can do this is basically the XOR property, which is if A XOR B is P, then you basically get A XOR P gives back B. Okay, or if you have B XOR P, that gives you A. Okay, that's a very simple property of the XOR operator. So if you basically compute P is your redundant information, A and B are blocks, data blocks that you are going to store on disks. So what you will now do, okay, in the simplest RAID level, you will have two, for any two disks or any n disk, you will have a parity disk. Okay? So you will basically take blocks here and you will compute a parity block by doing XOR. Okay, and this is actually arbitrary, so you don't have to just have two things. If you have you get parity. If any one of these fails, if you plug in that parity there, you can reconstruct that. Okay, that's basically, you can extend this to this. Okay? So the basic idea is you take some number of disks, you take some blocks from there, you compute an XOR of that block, that gives you a parity block, you store that there. Okay? If any of this, if one disk goes down, if you wanted block I there, you will actually get a parity block. You'll get all these other blocks, you do an XOR that gives back the block that was stored on the failed disk. Okay. So typically if you do this, you can handle one disk failure. If you want to do multiple disk failure, you have to basically add additional redundancy. Same is true in mirroring. Okay, if you mirrored and you say both disks went down, then what do you do? Nothing much you can do. Right? All of your data is gone. The original and the copy is both gone. Okay. So RAID, by definition, RAID levels 1 through 5 handle single disk failures. If you want to handle multiple disk failures, you have to add more redundancy. Okay, you have to have at least two pieces of redundant information. So if those two disks go down, you can plug in those two pieces back in there and reconstruct what was on that disk. Okay, is this clear, what I just said? Any questions? This is essentially what RAID does. Okay, so I'll talk about the other levels. But the point is, rather than keeping a copy, rather than keeping one bit for every one original bit, you have one bit for n bits. So there's one backup bit that is backing up n different bits or bytes on your disk array. Okay? And if any of those in pieces go away, you can plug that in and reconstruct. Okay? So now what are all these RAID levels? They are just depending on how you compute the parity. This is the parity disk here, as you will see. Depending on how you compute the parity and how you store it on the various disks, you have different RAID levels. Okay? So RAID level 3, I'm going to ignore 2 because it's never used. Okay, so it's called bit interleaved parity. Okay? You basically compute parity on a bit basis. Okay, exactly what I showed you here. For every bit, so you take a sector, it has 512 bytes. Okay, that's 512 times 8 bits. So for every bit, you do this operation and you store a parity bit on a separate disk. Okay, that is referred to as bit interleaved parity. Okay, so you'll take the first bit here, compute a parity bit, second bit. So this is all done in hardware. Okay, so the hardware will do this for you. As you're storing data, you'll compute parity on a bit by bit basis. Okay. RAID 4 does this on a block by block basis, okay, rather than a bit by bit basis, which is more intuitive for us. So if you are basically I've already mentioned striping. So let's say you're striping a file. Okay, so you store the first block here, second block here, third block here. You take these blocks, you XOR the blocks. Okay, you get a parity block. Okay, then you store the parity block there. Okay? And then you store the fourth block here, fifth block here, sixth block here. Okay, then this is a stripe group, what's called a stripe group. You take these three blocks, you XOR, get the second parity block, and so on and so forth. So if you do this on a block basis, this is called RAID level 4. If you do this on a bit basis, which means you take the first bit here, second bit here, so if you, depending on what level you're doing this XOR operation, you get these two different RAID levels. Yes, question.
Is there any advantage?
Is there any advantage? The only advantage, okay, here I should also mention the striping is also done on a bit level. Okay, the only advantage here is you basically, in this case, any access will always access all of the, because you're storing the first bit here, second bit here, third bit here, fourth bit here. Any access causes all the disks to be used. If you do it on a block basis, like you do here, if you want to access a second block, you'll only go and access this block. Okay? Otherwise, if you have to access the second block of the file, that's so many bits, those bits are always scattered. So in this case, so this is always full parallelism. Every I/O request actually requires you to go to all of the disks. And remember that this disk still do seeks. So even if you want to access one block, you'll get n seeks here. In this case, if you want to access one block, you only have one seek, because you only go to that block and access it. Okay, so there are these nuances, but from a failure handling perspective, it's identical. It can handle a disk, single disk failure. Okay, so RAID 5, which is the most common RAID level, okay, for tolerating single disk failure, does not have a dedicated parity disk. In these two cases, the parity block was actually stored on a dedicated parity disk. This basically scatters the parity blocks. Okay, so what happens in this case is, so you do 1, 2, 3, 4th block is the parity disk. So then you store 4, 5, store the 6th block there, and the parity for this stripe group is stored here. Okay, then you do 7, 8, 9, then you store the parity, and 11, 12, and so on. So the parity blocks are stored on all of the disks. Okay, and there is some advantage to this, because what happens in RAID 4 is every write to any of the blocks always also triggers an additional write to the parity disk, because you have to go and update that parity, recompute the parity and update it. Okay, so the parity disk becomes overloaded, because every write, regardless of which disk it is hitting, also hits that disk. Okay, so your system slows down. By storing the parity everywhere, you scatter the parity updating overhead, and went across all of the disks. Okay? That you don't have to know that level of detail, okay? But that's the reason why you actually do distributed parity. Okay? And the last scheme, it's called RAID 6, which I'll not talk about the scheme itself, but you have basically two types of parity blocks. So you can tolerate multiple disk failures. That's the only thing to keep in mind. Extra redundant information is kept, where if any two disks go down, you can still come take all of that extra information and recompute. Okay, is that clear? Any questions on this? Yeah, no question. Yeah, so there are other RAID schemes which I'll not talk about. There is RAID 10, which is effectively RAID 1 plus 0. Okay, so what you do there is you have a RAID 1 thing and then you mirror the entire array on another array. That's called RAID 10. Okay, and there's also RAID 0 plus 1, which is the opposite. You have a RAID 0 that's mirrored on another. So there are all these combinations. Effectively, anything else is just a combination of some of these. That's all. So if you have a mirrored array, two arrays that are mirroring one another, it's called RAID 1 plus 0, other than disks that are mirroring one another.
And they basically vary in performance, as in some are better for reading, and then some are better, like they're slower on writing, and then some are faster.
Yeah, so some are, most of these will be good for reads, because reads you are striping, so you will scatter all the reads. Some of them are not good for writing, because every write request requires you to read, reread the entire stripe group, recompute the parity, and write it back. Okay, so writes on these RAID arrays tend to be slow because of the need. If you update a block, the XOR of all of those stripe group has changed. So you have to go update the parity block. To update the parity block, you have to read all the blocks that you have used to compute all the parity. So a single write actually requires n reads. Okay, and then you recompute the parity, and then there are two writes, the actual write and the recomputed parity. Okay, so one write request becomes n plus two IOs on your subsystem. So writes are slow. There are problems like that that you have to deal with. Okay, so not material necessary for this class, but something to keep in mind. Any questions here? Okay, so that's RAID. And then there was something on tape that I wanted to say. Okay, so tertiary devices. So that's why we talked about magnetic disks. We talked about disk arrays. And the last thing I wanted to say was something about tertiary storage. Okay, so beyond disks, there are other storage medium that are used mostly as backup medium. Okay, so to backup data. So there are tape drives, there are zip drives, there are CD drive, read write medium. Okay, these are, as I mentioned, worm devices, write ones, read many devices, and then there are robotic jukeboxes that will automate some of these things. What most of these are used for typically is to store information that is basically backup of what is stored on your secondary storage. Okay, primary storage is memory, secondary storage is disk, this is called tertiary storage. Okay, so it's basically storing a backup of what's there on the disk. Okay. Now typically, let's say 10 years ago, tapes were significantly cheaper than disks. Okay, so if you had lots and lots of data, what you would do is you would put a copy of it in tape and store only the part of the data you want on disk. Okay, so this is how you would do backups. But as the cost of disk has gone down significantly, what has happened now is tape drives are more or less at some level are becoming obsolete. They're still used, but they're quickly becoming obsolete. Because what people do now is that you keep a backup on cheaper disk instead of keeping it on tape. Okay, so you have an expensive storage system, very fast disks, or a RAID system. And then you buy ultra cheap disks, you go buy this PC class $100 terabyte disks, and you store a copy on that disk. Okay, so tertiary storage is essentially now also disks is what is happening in many environments, because the cost of buying tape and cost of buying a disk, a typical tape cartridge costs $50. Okay, it basically stores hundreds of gigabytes. For $100 you can get a 1 terabyte PCI disk. So why should you go with tape? You can just buy cheaper disks. These are more expensive. What goes into these things are more expensive disks. Okay, they're faster disks, they spin faster, they're more reliable. But you have all these cheaper disks that you can buy. So many systems actually use disks as their tertiary backup medium. Okay, so backups are also stored somewhere on disk. Yeah, but that said, tapes are still used widely. as backup medium, so I wanted to say a few words about tapes. Okay. So this thing, the first point is tape is much less expensive, no longer true. Okay, the prices of discs have fallen, so they are more or less little bit less expensive, okay, but not significantly. That doesn't make as much sense from an economic perspective. Okay, but the interesting thing about tape is that the access medium is very different. Okay, if I don't know, most of you may not have seen a tape drive, okay, but you have seen a VHS cassette, right, a video cassette. Okay, so tape is essentially like that. You actually store your bits on this medium that spins. Yeah, it's like a magnet, it's like a tape, like a VHS tape. And basically, as you can imagine, this is a very slow medium. Yeah, so if you have actually stored something at the end of the test, think of you are watching a movie on a VCR. Okay? You want to go to the last scene of the movie. Okay? It's not instantaneous. If you are watching this movie on a DVD, it's almost random access. Right? You just go to the chapter title, you just pick the last chapter and you are there. Okay, very quick. If you are viewing the same movie on a VCR, you are going to do a fast forward. It will probably take 2-3 minutes for the tape to actually seek to the end, and then you basically start playing from that part. Okay? Exact same thing is true for data storage, okay, on tape. Okay? It's a linear medium. If your file is stored at the end of the tape, the thing is going to keep spinning until the right part of the tape appears. Okay? So getting to a file may take minutes because this thing has to spin until the right thing appears, and then you can read or write to it. Okay. So as a random access device, it's essentially a sequential device. So to do random access on tapes is very, very slow. Okay, unlike disks or other medium that we are. Which is why it's more suitable for backups, because if you're trying to recover a file from backup because you deleted your original file or your disk crashed, at that point you are willing to wait a few minutes. Okay, but if you are just trying to load this file into your editor to edit it, you don't want to wait 5 minutes after you hit open. Okay, so tapes are good for archival, okay, which is essentially what backups are for, but not good for interactive I/O. Okay, that's something to keep in mind. Because of the linear nature of tape, it's very slow to go to a certain file that's stored somewhere on tape and access it. Okay? That's the only thing to keep in mind. The other thing is, just as you have this RAID where you might have multiple disks, okay? Very large backup systems have multiple tape drives. Okay? And they are robotic tape drives. So what you have then is basically an array of tapes. Okay, so this is tape 1, this is tape 2, this is tape 3. So as data is coming in, you'll basically start putting stuff on first tape. As this tape fills up, you'll send it to the second tape and the third tape. So you have this array of tapes. And more interestingly, there's no human that is actually, once this tape fills up, the human does not take this tape off and put a new tape in to start recording. There's a robot that does that, because there's a robotic arm that will just take that tape down and put a new tape in. Okay, very similar to the jukeboxes that you see in sports bar. Right? You basically say, I want to play CD 33, something actually takes the CD and plops it in and it starts playing music. Same thing is true here. You basically have a collection of tape that this thing is managing. It can just take a new tape, put it in, or take an old tape, put it out, and so on. Okay, so this is how you actually do very large backups even now. Okay? Okay, that's basically what robotic tapes library do, which are also called silos here. Any questions on this? Okay. So we have talked about disks, file systems, and so on. Now we will actually talk more generally about I/O subsystems in general. Okay? In some sense, what does the OS kernel have to do I/O, regardless of whether it's disk, tape, or any other device. Okay, so how does the hardware influence the IS, what services are OS rather, what services are provided, and what can you do to optimize these services. Okay, so let me start off with a picture. Okay, so this is your I/O subsystem on a PC. That's the hardware view of your I/O subsystem. We looked at this very early on, okay, when I talked about memory, CPU, there was a system bus and so on. Now we are blowing up the I/O component of it. That is what it looks like. I/O buses vary, but I mean the PCI bus or PCIX, all these buses are still very common. Because this is the medium that is used to communicate, and all of these things are I/O devices. Okay? Every I/O device has a controller. Okay, there's a graphics card, there's a graphics card that has a controller. There's a controller for the disk, that's an IDE controller. There's a controller for the keyboard, there's a controller for SCSI disks and so on. Okay, attached to these controllers are the I/O devices themselves. Okay, so this is a picture to keep in mind. We are going to come back to this. Okay, so but I just wanted to start off the picture of what your I/O subsystem on your laptop or your on your desktop or servers look like. Okay. So you have a system bus, okay, which is used to communicate between the CPU and I/O devices. And typical I/O devices, basically a generic I/O device, essentially looks like this. Okay, it has these four components. So let me just. Okay, so there are four registers on any I/O device. Okay, there's a status register, there's a command register, there's a data in register, and a data out register. Okay, it's a generic view of a device, doesn't matter what it is. Okay. The way typically the OS interacts with devices is that it writes out a command to the command register saying do the following. If it's, and then typically you're either doing input or output. You're either reading something from the device or writing. So if you're writing, then you'll actually write something to this register saying this is the data I want to write out. The command tells you where to write that out. Okay? And the device will then go off and do it. Okay? Because this is the command that you send to the device by writing that command into a register and a hardware register that's on the device. And the reading is the same way. You basically write out a command saying I want to read this. Okay, and after some time, the data has actually appeared in this register. Okay, the device will read it and put it into this register. You will actually get an interrupt or you may be polling as we will see. And then the CPU can read from this register. Okay, there's general generic view of a device. Okay, typically the way you do this is there is something called a port on that device. Okay, a port essentially are these four registers. Okay, so you basically interact by writing out commands into the command register, that's the control register, and there's a data in and a data out register that is actually used to send data to the device or read data from the device. Okay, the thing that is actually taking care of that is the controller. Okay, the picture that I showed you. Okay. So once you write out to a port, the controller will actually do the necessary stuff to read or write. Yeah, so it basically receives commands, translates them to device action and reads and writes to the system bus. Yeah, so every device has a controller and you communicate with this via a port. And devices vary in flavor. We have only looked at disk drive, but as you will see, a whole bunch of them. Okay, printers, keyboard, mouse, all of these are devices. And there are non-traditional ones like joysticks if you have a gaming device and whatnot. Okay, so this is the software view. Okay, this was the hardware view of your I/O subsystem. This is the software view of your I/O subsystem. Okay, so these are your devices. These are the controllers. There's a controller for each device. Okay, as I said, there's a port that you will basically write to, and then the device controller actually does something with the device. Okay, and this is where the software ends. Okay, this is the hardware side of things, the software. So basically the lowest level of your operating system are your device drivers. Okay. The device drivers are the one responsible for actually interacting with the device controller, okay, doing writing to the ports, reading from the ports, and so on. So this has to be a device driver for each device in your system, each I/O device in the system. Okay, there's a general I/O subsystem that interacts with the device driver. Okay, so but a lot of the heavy lifting is actually happening in the device driver itself. The device driver knows specifically what the device is, how to interact with it, what commands the device can take, and so on. I mean, each device will have its own command set, each I/O device. So that's what the device driver is programmed to do. Okay? Alright, so here are just, I talked about ports, I'm not going to go into details here. But each port has a specific address associated with it for a PC. Yeah, so you use that address to communicate with that device. Yeah, so these are just general address ranges for various devices. Okay, so this is the serial port, more or less gone away now. Okay, so there is a parallel port, it's also basically not there. So there's a timer, there's a game controller, that's your hard disk controller. Okay, that's the address you use to communicate with disks for it. So yes, question.
So each one of these books have a port.
Yes. Every device has a unique address. It says this is the address for that device. Okay, so that's how you talk to the device. Every device also has those ports. Yes, each device has the port. So basically that's, and then you use the port to communicate with the device controller. Okay, you say this is the command I want to do. Okay, so for keyboard, you'll only do reads typically. So it'll say somebody is a key press, you'll basically read that from the device in. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, so that is the port location. Okay, so now let's look at the services that are provided to you by the OS. Okay, on Unix systems, okay, devices actually appear as if they are files. So higher level applications, programs, daemons can interact with devices as if they are reading and writing files. What the IO subsystem will then do, okay, is will take this abstraction of a file and then it will map onto specific commands for that device. Okay, so what that also says is all devices in a Unix environment appear as if they were files. Okay, so if you actually go on into the slash dev directory, okay, you will actually see an entry for every device. Okay, I can show you an example. I think I showed this sometime back. Yeah, actually I could. That's true. Good point. Okay, so here is the slash dev directory. Okay, so that's just a listing of it. You'll see that here are all the USB devices. Okay, so they just appear as if they are files. This is not, they are not real files. Okay, they just have you get an abstraction of a file. So if I open slash dev slash USB device 3 or whatever this thing is, okay, I can actually directly communicate with that device, assuming I have root or privileged access. Okay, if I write to it, as if I am just writing to a file, I just say write, use the write system call, it will go to the IO subsystem, and the IO subsystem will say, what is this type of device? Then it will translate that write call into a specific command for that device, and then that command is sent to that device. So you don't, by treating devices as files, you don't have to deal with the intricacies of different devices. Okay, typically you say generically you only read and write to devices, so we'll just provide you a read-write interface and you have a file interface that does that. So you just pretend that devices were files. Okay, yes, question.
Where is the slash dev directory on the Mac?
Where is it?
Because like usually I know it's in the Linux.
Yeah, so you don't see it on a Mac.
Okay.
So if you actually look at this thing, you will not. Right, so it is actually not, it's not made visible because it's a system directory. So if you just do this, right, so if you just open this thing, you will not see it. Okay, but it's actually there in root. So if you go and do this, you will actually see those devices. Okay, so TTY devices are terminals. Okay, so here is disk 0. That's the raw interface to the disk. Okay, so if I open slash dev slash disk 0, I can actually directly write to sectors or blocks on that disk, okay, by bypassing the file system completely. Okay, so you can do that. So your mouse is a device, you'll see that I have my phone is a device. Okay, so if you actually sync with your iTunes, that's basically my phone. There's a PDA that I had long time back. I have a Bluetooth modem, that's a device. So there are a whole bunch of these devices. Just use the file interface to talk to them. Okay, so you don't have to deal with what is the actual command for this device and whatnot. Okay, Now this is just an abstraction. This doesn't eliminate the need to have device drivers and so on, but from a programmer standpoint, you don't have to deal with different devices differently. Okay, they all appear as if they are files in Unix like file systems. Okay, and then you deal with them that way. Okay, there has to be an access control clearly. Okay, so only if you are not root, typically you will not be able to access devices, because you said IO access is a privileged operation. If you go back to lecture 2 or lecture 3, if you remember, we had all these instructions that required you to be in kernel mode. Okay. So if you try to open a device, typically if you are not root, you will not be able to do that. The way it is enforced here is by actually making root the owner of the device and then not giving you permissions. Okay, so if you are basically only root, then you can do read or write. Ordinary users cannot even do it. Okay, so that's basically how it works. Okay, so you have to have access control. Okay, only system processes or the operating system has direct access to devices. Okay, there are things like device allocations, or devices have numbers. In Unix operating system, there's something called a major number and there's something called a minor number. The major number identifies the type of a device. Is it disk? Is it a mouse? Is it a keyboard? And if we have more than one of those class of devices, so the minor number orders those types. So if you have disk, you may have disk 1, disk 2, disk 3 and so on. They will all have the same major number but different minor numbers. Okay? So you have to do those allocations. You have to allocate an address for the device. You have to have an interrupt vector for the device and whatnot. Okay? There are several optimizations you do. We'll talk about this as buffering, caching and spooling to allow efficient communication. You have to do I/O scheduling. Okay? We already looked at I/O scheduling in the context of disk. As a disk is a device, you just keep sending commands, okay, through these registers. Okay, what the disk does internally is it takes a queue of these commands and it reorders them using seek or look or whatever other things we looked at last time. Okay. So the disk itself will do scheduling based on whatever commands it has received. Okay. Most devices may not do that. They may just employ simple FCFS scheduling. Okay. But certain devices will do scheduling, which means reorder the request and service them in that order. Okay. Last but not least, you have to actually deal with error handling. Okay. Whenever you do I/O, errors may be common. Okay. So then you have to basically get handle errors appropriately by retrying some number of times, for instance. Okay, so you may have to do that or write the device driver so it retries a few number of times before it throws back an error to the application. Okay, and as I said, for every device you need a device driver. That's a piece of code that's written specifically to communicate to that device. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about two different ways of communicating with these devices using these mechanisms. Okay. First one is called polling. This is a very simple mechanism. Okay. So here, what you do is whenever you want to communicate with a device, okay, you basically write out a command into its command register. Okay. The status register actually tells you what the status is. Okay. I didn't really mention it, but it was there here. Okay. The status register says, is it busy, is it idle, is the device ready, okay, is there an error on the device, is the device ready to accept new commands, or is it busy accept processing a command. Okay, so this tells you what the device is doing at any point. This is what the OS tells the device to do. Okay, so okay, so you wait, you keep reading. So basically when you do polling, essentially, so you say while status is not idle, just loop, okay, do nothing. Okay, just wait until the device becomes ready. Okay. Once it has become ready, then you write to the command register. You write a new command. If you are doing write, then you write something optionally to the output register. Okay, saying this is what I need to write. Okay, and then you wait. And then you just do busy wait. Okay, so you set the command to ready, then the device then goes off and starts processing your I/O request. The status turns to busy and it is processing whatever command you sent it. While that is processing the command, you keep polling. Okay, you keep reading the status register. Is the I/O done? Is the I/O done? So you keep reading the status and say, is it done? So long as the status is busy, you know that the I/O is still being processed. Okay? Eventually, the device will be done with whatever command you sent it. Okay? At that point, you will basically go and either read the data or look at the output saying, was there an error or did the command execute successfully? Okay. So this is referred to as polling. You send off a command and you keep checking. You keep polling the device saying, is the command complete? So you will do a busy wait until the command finishes and then you issue the next command. So this is the simplest form of communication that a device driver can use to communicate with the device. Okay, is that clear? So what is the disadvantage of this approach? Sorry? You're wasting time. You're doing busy wait. Okay, we already said many times before, busy waiting is bad. The CPU is not doing anything useful while it waits for the command to complete. I/O devices by definition are slow. Okay, so you just sit there waiting for this command to complete. Okay, nothing useful is happening on the CPU at that point in time. The CPU is executing the device driver code, not just reading this register and checking is the command done. Okay, typically you don't want to do that. Okay, so how would you avoid that? Okay, you will use interrupt. So you already looked at this back in the first few classes. So more modern devices will support an interrupt interface. You can of course do polling, but they will do also support interrupts. So in this case, what will happen, okay, is that you will write out a command, okay, and then you will just let the device do its thing, and the device driver will just wait, and the OS will actually start executing some other process. Okay, the process that issued the command will also be in wait state. The device driver is just blocked waiting for the command to complete. Okay. When the device is done processing the command, it will raise an interrupt. The interrupt will cause the CPU to suspend the execution of the current process. You will go back into the interrupt service routine. The interrupt service routine will say, this disk actually raised an interrupt. You will go back to the device driver saying, you are blocked on this request. Your request is done, go process it. Okay, so the device driver will then go read. If you had sent off a read request to the disk, the data would have actually appeared here. Okay, and then in this buffer or this register, you will read it from there and then you will resume execution of that process. Okay, so what you have done is you have eliminated the busy wait. You use an interrupt as a way for the device to signal the OS saying the command that was sent to it is done. And while the IO command is being processed, the OS can do other useful things, execute other processes. Okay, this is what is done in most devices. There is a picture here that shows how this works. Device driver initiates IO by actually writing to the register, etc. Okay, and then you just wait for the signal. Okay, and then at that point, you will basically come back here. Okay, so in this, so you are blocked here. So in this period, the CPU is executing something else. Okay, this is the point at which the interrupt comes, because in this time something else is executed between the time you initiated the IO and the interrupt came. Okay, the interrupt comes, you will go to the ISR and you will do all of the things I said. Okay, process the request, read the data, and then you resume the processing of the interrupted task. Okay, that's a pictorial depiction of what I just said. Any questions on this? Okay. So these are various vectors, which I guess we talked about some of these before. The only interesting one for us is, which one is it? Null interrupt break exception device not. So this is saying that the device is busy. Yeah, that's an interrupt, or not the device is busy, that there's an error on the device is not available. Okay. And that's about the only one. That's interesting. Okay, so this is not a complete table, but these are not device specific interrupts. I'm not sure why this slide is here. Okay, we'll ignore this slide. Okay. But I do want to talk about a new a different way to access IO devices. Okay. Polling is one. Okay. Interrupts is the second one. Okay. Now the advantage of interrupts is you got rid of the busy wait. Okay. But still, when the interrupt comes, the CPU has to go and process the results of the IO command. Okay. The CPU is still in the critical path. If you have to basically, if you are reading from a disk, it has to go go into the register, start reading the bytes out and put it in memory. Okay? So what that says is that CPU is still going to process some cycles, trying to finish off the processing of that I/O request. What DMA does is that it eliminates, it reduces the burden on the CPU even further. Okay? In polling the CPU, so the point is the spectrum, in polling the CPU is always involved. Okay, starting when it issued the request, it keeps doing busy wait until the request finishes and then it processes the results that have come back. In interrupts, you start off, you initiate the request, CPU is involved at that point to set, and then you do something else. But when the request finishes, you then go and do the post-processing. You read the data from the device and whatnot. In DMA, the CPU is only involved in the first step, which is issuing the request. And from that point on, the device takes care of the rest. Okay, so the way this works is, and this is useful if you have to transfer, read or write large volumes of data, like a disk block, which is let's say 4 kilobytes. Okay. If this register is giving you one byte at a time, you can imagine that reading a 4 kilobyte block requires the post-processing to read this register 4,000 times. Okay, not 4,000, 4K times. Okay. So that's a lot of CPU involvement. Rather, what you can actually do is tell the device saying, go read this data, and once you've read it, directly transfer it to this memory location. Okay. You don't have to interrupt me, just go ahead and just transfer all of the data that you are reading from your device into this memory location. Okay? And then you basically go and do something else. So what then happens is the device not only reads the data, okay, it actually goes and transfers that data to the right memory location. And after all of this is done, then you interrupt saying the data is arrived, it's been put in the memory location you specified, and go ahead and process it. Yes, question. Right. So what this requires is a new thing called a DMA controller. I thought I had a picture here. So what you basically do is there is a new piece of hardware called a DMA controller that is responsible for taking stuff from here and storing it in RAM. Okay. So the way you typically do is you will basically send off a command to the device, you will tell the DMA controller whatever is coming here, just read it and put it at this memory location. Okay? The CPU will go ahead and do whatever it wants. This device can then poll, this device controller rather, can then this actually poll this device, and when the data is coming in, take one byte at a time or bits at a time and keep writing to the memory location, or if you are writing to the device, it will actually read bytes at a time and keep writing into this register and keep sending the data to the device, okay? Without CPU intervention. Okay, this is, think of it as a smaller CPU on the side that is doing a side task that the CPU would have, the main CPU would have done. The controller or the logic on the controller is doing all of this thing. Okay? So the CPU doesn't have to be involved in large data transfers. If you're just reading one byte or few bytes, this does not matter. But when you're writing kilobytes or megabytes of data, this does matter. If the CPU is in the critical path, the performance of your system goes down drastically. Okay, so you use this DMA controller to directly access RAM, okay, and then either read from RAM and put that data on device, or read from the device and put that data in RAM, okay, without CPU intervention. Okay, so modern day devices that support high volume transfers will all support DMA as an additional mode of access, in addition to, of course, doing polling and interrupt. It's up to the device driver to figure out which of these three things to use. For any request, should you use interrupt, should you use polling, should you use DMA? Okay, so that's the job of the device. You implement your device driver, you can decide based on the type of command which of these three modes to use to interact with the device. Typically, devices may support more than one mode. Okay? So a few more details about types of devices. Okay. So typically there are two types of devices on a that you use. There's one, something called a character device and something called a block device. Okay. And this has to do with, just one thing, this has to do in how you interact with the device, one character at a time or one block at a time. Yes, you have a question.
What happens when the CPU and the DMA operate on the bus the same, and they want to operate on the same?
Right. Okay, so question is, what will happen if the... what happens if your CPU, which is here, and the device controller, the DMA controller, which is not shown here, want to access the bus? So the bus is the arbitration mechanism. Okay, so there will be always there will be contention for the bus. It doesn't matter. You might have multiple cores here. You have RAM here. Okay, then the access to that RAM will go through the system bus. So you will, this bus will always arbitrate. Okay, but bus is, think of bus as a very fast communication medium. So just because the DMA controller is writing to memory and the CPU is also reading instructions from memory doesn't mean that the bus has become a bottleneck. Because the speed of memory and the speed of bus is fast enough to sustain both of those types of accesses concurrently. Okay? So if accesses over the bus will still be concurrent, there will still be contention, but the bus is fast enough. So there's no problem there. Okay. So as I was saying, all devices you can basically partition into two parts, the character device or a block device. If you are reading one byte at a time or one character at a time from the device, you have a character device. If you can write chunks of data, okay, you have a block device. Okay. So a disk clearly falls into a block device category because you are writing entire sectors which are blocks. Okay. What are examples of character devices? Where would you want to write one byte or read one byte at a time? Network? Network, you send out a packet. Packet is a collection of bytes. So it's better to treat a network device as a block device. Anytime your I/O granularity is more than a byte, you want to do this. Anytime the I/O granularity is this, in one character at a time, you want to do this. Okay, so network, better off putting. You can make any block device character device also, incidentally, but they're more efficient to do that. Yes, your suggestion. Keyboard. You press a keystroke, you're generated one character. Okay, so you read. Mouse is another character device. Yeah, and so on and so forth. So if you want to know what kind of device something is, you basically, what you have to do is you actually go here. Okay, and this first letter tells you whether it's a block device or a character device. If it says a C, that says it's a character device. If it says a B, that's a block device. Okay? And you will see that things like a keyboard, which I don't think we see here. So here is your block. Okay, so here is your disk. You'll see that it's a block device. Okay, so that's the transfer unit. The second way to characterize devices is the device sequential or random. Okay, if the device allows you to write or read from arbitrary location, it's a random access device. Disks are random access devices, for instance. Okay, all devices also have to be categorized into these two things. So a keyboard, by definition, has to be a sequential device. There is no jumping around. You are just reading a stream of keystrokes. Okay, you are reading them sequentially, sequential device. Okay, the third way to categorize this is whether the devices are synchronous or asynchronous. Okay, does the OS have to do blocking operation or asynchronous non-blocking operation? Certain devices require you to block while the command is being executed. Certain other devices which support interrupts and whatnot allow you to have asynchronous calls where you basically say, go and implement this IO execute this IO operation. It would be a DMA device, and that's non-blocking essentially because this OS can go do something else and the device goes off and does its own thing. Okay. So whether the OS has to block on the IO operation or you can just send off the IO command, do something else, tells you whether the device is synchronous or asynchronous. Okay, and then there are a whole bunch of other things, whether it's shared or dedicated, okay, whether it's an input device, output device, or both. Keyboard is an example of an input-only device. You can never write to a keyboard. Okay. Your monitor is an example of an output-only device. You can never read a monitor unless you have a touch screen, which is a different type of a monitor. A touch screen monitor is both read and write, but normal monitors are write-only, not read. Okay, disks are an example of read-write. You can both read and write. So you can do different types of operations depending on a device, and certain things are not allowed. Okay, so keyboard says sequential character, disk is block, device random or sequential. Okay, here is basically a much longer list of things. Okay, so I already talked about disks, I mean the character block devices, sequential, okay, lots of them, keyboards, modem, they are all sequential. Okay, random disks, okay, your synchronous tape is a synchronous example of a synchronous device. Keyboard is an example of an asynchronous device. Okay, you don't actually have a device driver for your keyboard waiting for the next keystroke. When you press a key here, the keyboard actually generates an interrupt, and then the device driver goes processes it. Yes, question.
What about when you take a snapshot of the screen?
What happens when you do a snapshot of the screen? What?
So is it reading from the screen, like the
Okay, question is what happens when you take a snapshot of the screen? What you actually do when you take a snapshot is you actually read the graphics card's memory buffer and you just dump that somewhere into a file. Okay, so every pixel here, okay, so whatever you're seeing here is actually in the graphics card buffer. So each of this is a pixel and that pixel value is written. So think of a pixel, the graphics card as a two-dimensional buffer. And if you write to a particular value there, that color pixel appears on your screen. Okay, so everything here is basically represented as bits of pixels in your graphics card. And you do a screenshot, which is writing that buffer and dumping it. Okay. But it's not writing. Remember that. You're just reading that and you're storing that. But you're not reading from the monitor itself. Okay, so what was I saying? So here, this is synchronous, asynchronous. As far as sharing is concerned, it depends on what type of device it is. Okay, dedicated device is a tape. Only one process typically can read or write. Keyboard is an example of a shared device. Multiple processes can access the keyboard at any time. Okay, if you have Internet Explorer or Firefox running and you have Word open, okay, depending on which process you make active, you can get keyboard input and provide input. Okay, so this device is essentially shared by multiple processes. That's what's called shared. There's device speed of latency and whatnot, we'll talk about that. And then there's I/O direction. We talked about read-only, read-write and so on. Okay. So, I think we have run out of time, but next time I will talk about more about character devices and whatnot. Okay. Just a reminder, there's a homework we put out last time. Okay. It's due next Tuesday. Just keep that in mind.